in Harry. So there was David Wright out today, right? So Rob emailed me desperately at 12 o'clock last night and said, "Do you have something?" I said, "I have something." But so this, I mean, it's not going to be super well rehearsed. I gave this talk in Sydney, June 24th. There's some things in the end that I've changed. It's not best, I haven't presented them in the best way. So I'm going to use the blackboard in the end. So, hello? Oh, is this on, by the way?
Yes.
Yeah, it's on. So, just to maybe start with what the scolium problem is. So, also, the original Beamer file is in Sydney, so I couldn't modify my slides today. So here's from another article I'm writing with Dean Rickles in Sydney and a student of Steve Bartlett, Maki Takahashi. So, where's the... Oh, there it is. So this is basically Newton's scolium problem. This is within Newtonian mechanics. It's about... here it is. It is indeed a matter of great difficulty to discover and effectively to distinguish true motions of particular bodies from the apparent, because the parts of that immovable space, so this is talking about absolute space now, in which those motions are performed, do by no means come under the observations of our senses. So he's talking about true motions, which he thinks of motions with respect to absolute space. And then there are apparent motions, because you yourself could be in an inertial, in a accelerator reference frame, rotating and so on. So even though an object might appear to be accelerating and moving, it might be that there's no forces on the object and it's, you know, do not really change with respect to absolute space. So he recognizes the problem here that he wants this notion of true motions and apparent motions, and he recognizes there's a tension here, right? And he wants to be able to determine the true motions from the apparent motions, the directly observed, what you as an observer empirically see out there. And he continues to say, yet the thing is not altogether desperate, for we have some arguments to guide us partly from the apparent motions, which are the differences of the true motions, partly from the forces, and he says something here. This problem here, to sort of determine the motion in absolute space and time from directly observed motions, this is what Newton's scolium problem is. He attributes great importance to this this problem.
Yeah. The word scolium, is that like a comment?
Oh, good. That's very good. Yeah, this is a commentary, right? So Newton has the mathematical setup in Principia. Very good. So this is a bit unrehearsed because in Newton's Principia, you find these scoliums here and there when he sort of tries to give a more in-depth explanation of the concepts and how it relates to the theory in general. So this scolium, as referred to here, is the scolium in which you find the bucket experiment and the rotating body, two planets, and so on, which is sort of a direct criticism against relational ideas. So as a comment on that also, when you actually read the scolium, you realize that Newton had thought much harder about it than is generally sort of, known. This is sort of about that, to sort of see how Newton thought about absolute space and time and how they're sort of manifest in his theory, and also through this problem, how you can determine motions in absolute space and time through relational observations only, and to what extent you can do that. So he's talking about the rotating globes and other stuff. But in the end, he writes, but how are we to obtain the true motions from their causes, effects, and apparent differences, and the converse, should be explained here more at large in the following treatise. For to this end it was that I composed it. So this is very strange, this last sentence, because he's saying that he composed the entire Principia to solve this problem. And then, of course, you never find the solution to the problem in the Principia. So everybody's looking at the Newton's, or the bucket experiments, and the sort of the two rotating globes. But as Julian Barbers pointed out, this problem which Newton puts real big emphasis on, and this is the Scholium problem. So this talk is trying to introduce this more and make it sort of mathematically precise. What are the things we have to solve for? What are the unknowns? What are the empirical data we can observe, and so on? That's sort of the scope of it. Thank you for the clarification. I was just jumping right into it. So any questions at this point? Just fine? Super clear? Oh, now we go to the real talk. So this is the outline of the talk. We're going to talk more about the notions of relative time and absolute time. I'm going to sort of get into this Scholium problem through the quest of defining a theoretical notion of time. How do we define what a good clock is? How can we say if this clock is accurate? What would we mean by that, that it's accurate? Can we measure the inaccuracy of a clock? And how do we do that without comparison to a second clock, whose accuracy we don't know also? So the talk is sort of going here. We're for the quest of a theoretical notion of time, and then we end up with the full Scholium problem. A theoretical notion of time is part of the Scholium problem, but when you try to solve it, you think that everything becomes intermixed and you need to solve the full Scholium problem, which means how do you determine actual duration, the motion with respect to inertial reference frames, and also masses and constants and all, everything becomes very intertwined and you need to solve simultaneously for all these unknowns. So there are different notions of time. Sidereal time, which we'll talk about, and it's sort of failure. This is just basically you look at the stars and they move constantly because Earth is rotating basically constantly. Then we're going to look at a different notion of time called ephemeris time, which Julian Barber has for a long time been saying this is the proper notion of time. Also, this thing has its problems because there are unknowns in the expression of ephemeris time, like masses, constants, and also your relation with respect to inertial reference frame. So there are a lot of unknowns there, and it's not yet operational. You cannot really use it like that. So it's only when you solve for the full Scholium problem that you're going to have a good notion of time or know how to reconstruct that. So hopefully that will become clearer later on.
Does Newton place an equal emphasis on time, the ambiguity in measuring time, as he did motion? I mean, in what you showed us, it was kind of about motion. Things of space, absolute
yes.
space.
So that might be my artifact here. I have to go back and check, but it's sort of... here's a quote from the Principia when he's talking about absolute versus... absolute and mathematical time versus relative time. So this is also in the Scholium. So there he is placing emphasis on... Well, so let me read the quote and maybe continue. Absolute, true, and mathematical time. This is important. This says mathematically is interesting here. And mathematical time of itself and from its own nature flows equally without relation to anything external, and by another name is called duration. Relative, apparent, and common time is some sensible and external, whether inaccurate or unequable, measure of duration by which means by the means of motion, which is commonly used instead of true time, such as an hour, a day, a month, a year. So in this quote from the Scholium, his commentary, he's distinguished between two distinct notions of time. Of course, it doesn't give any equations here, so it's a little bit hard to know exactly what it means now with absolute time and common time, or apparent time, or relative time. So, well, that's supposed to be synonymous here. So here, this is pretty common what it means, right? Relative time, that's what I have on a watch. But then he says, well, this might only be, this might be accurate or not accurate or unequivocal. So there's this different notion of time, which he calls absolute time also. So there's two notions. So so I'm going to go back to this thing that he's actually putting mathematically here. So in the Newtonian equations of motion, you have a T in there. So just as a very basic fundamental question, does the T in Newton's equations of motion represent absolute or relative time? So that's the first question, right? And if you now look at what people are actually doing after Einstein, they're all taking T to represent relative time. That's a bit counter to what you would think. Because consider this situation. We all did it and done this as university students, right? You have some, or maybe high school even, or even before that. You have some pendulum, and you just want to, you know, see how theta varies with time. This is your theory. It comes from Newtonian equations of motions. And you can measure theta, and then you want to see that theta as a function of time that comes from this expression is what you measure in the lab. But then it's just assumed that the T you find in there is the T that's on your accurate watch. So when people apply Newton's laws, it's the relative time interpretation that's being used.
I'm wondering if it's fair to say that physicists take it to represent relative time, or if they take it to represent absolute time, and for most practical purposes, they know that the clock on the wall will be a good representative of absolute time. But if you're doing something different, like astrophysics, you might say, no, the clock on the wall is not good enough. But for, you know, if you're measuring a pendulum, it is.
Yeah, so that sort of brings us to this question. Here, what you're saying, we have assumed that the laboratory clock represents an accurate clock, right? After all, we could not use any clock in order to test the predictions of our pendulum theory. So this comes in, we have an accurate clock. Now we're going to sort of take a first stab at this. Do we have any justification of this assumption now? Can we justify it from this theory? Well, this alone, I don't know if I should go into this, but it's clear from this simple theory here, this thing, that we cannot have any internal justification of this assumption that T is a good time. There's just one parameter in there. You just have to add it as an assumption. This is a good time, this clock here, and that's it. Is that sort of clear?
Are you saying it's not possible to determine whether a clock is an accurate representative of absolute time unless you deal with the physics of the clock?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Good, that's good clarification. So within this trivial model, right, it's just T as a real number. So of course we cannot have, it doesn't faithfully model the clock here, so we cannot justify this in any way. And here comes the fact that the external clock was not faithfully modeled or represented within our simple pendulum theory means that it's not possible to justify this accurate clock assumption within the simple pendulum theory. So the clock, that the clock is accurate has to be taken on faith. Perhaps we just trust the manufacturer. But then the question comes now, what do we even mean by an accurate clock? I mean, it's not sufficient to say, oh, it comes from this guy and I trust the guy. Why do you trust the guy? I mean, how do you know he's making good clocks? And here's, you know, as physicist, right, or theoretical physicist, we should be interested, what is the theoretical definition of an accurate clock? Some clocks are certainly more accurate than others. You have a pendulum clock versus a cesium clock. But how can we determine empirically which one is the better? How do you do this in practice? Some guys know how to do it, right? They construct good clocks. Against what exactly do we compare a clock to see that it's a good clock? And if a clock is inaccurate, how can such inaccuracy be numerically quantified or measured? So it's these type of questions that leads us more and more, it leads us to the Poole-Skolem problem. So that will be more clear in the end of the talk. So it should be clear that these questions cannot be answered satisfactorily if t is taken to represent relative time, because by definition there we just assume it's a good clock. This is also very much related to Einstein's remarks about special relativity. So he was uneasy about the fact that the existence of clocks, perfect clocks and rods, were just taken as a given, as sort of a primitive concept. So here we shall go on a different path, and we must, together with Newton, assume that the symbol t in the equations of motion represent absolute time, which flows without relation to anything external. So that's a very ethereal notion of time now. So here's to make it a bit more concrete. If you weed out all metaphysics, I mean, Newton were full of metaphysics. I mean, the absolute space was the sensorium of God and stuff like that. So we don't want to deal with all that stuff. So if you weed out all this metaphysics, then Newton's absolute time is simply this. It's the symbol t in Newton's equations of motion. Nothing more, nothing less. We won't be motivating all the metaphysics of Newton. We just say there's a t in the equations of motion. That thing is the absolute time. So it's a theory, rooted concept. It's because something is in the equations of motion. Now, let us go back to this emphasis Newton had on mathematical time, because now it's sort of made clear what I think this is just what Newton had in mind. There's a t in the equations of motion. That is the thing I'm calling absolute time. There's nothing more, I shouldn't say, from my perspective here, we shouldn't put in more metaphysics in this concept. And just there's a t in the equations of motion, and that's it. We call it absolute time. And now we can, sure?
Are we supposed to be thinking now as if the Newtonian theorem was correct? Or
yes.
To be?
Could it be?
Well, we could, I mean, if we saw it in a more modern way, we could say a good clock is one that measures the metric, you know, such that the
yes,
along the world line equals
or quantum mechanics
or something like that.
So that's a very good question. So there will be a Skolem problem for each theory we have. This is the Skolem in Newtonian theory. So and you will have the same question in general relativity, in special relativity, in quantum mechanics, and do this concept agree now? There's an interesting thing with ephemeris time in general relativity doesn't agree with Newtonian time, and it seems to be this, I mean, it's a bit, and modern clocks are based on quantum mechanics. So as a comment to that, what is absolute time in quantum mechanics? Well, it's the t in the Schrodinger equation. That would sort of be the answer there. And why does that notion of time agree with Newtonian time? Well, probably because there's a classical limit from one to another. But it's not very clear here, really. One has to make a substantial analysis to sort of see how things fit together. So from the point of view of the equations of motion...
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
So I don't want to end up in semantics. Maybe by metaphysics you mean some particular additions that Newton's put on, like the cosmic sensor or like the
God sensor. Yes, I just want to stick to the math and just be very dry.
But my point is that apart from these fancy words, you cannot really weed out completely the metaphysics, right? I mean, whatever...
Well, it depends what you mean by the metaphysics.
Yeah, that's why. Right.
Okay,
I don't want to go into semantics, but
okay.
Somehow, at some point, even if we will be dealing with how we measure the interval between T1 and T2, but we are assuming that T1 and T2 are two moments in time, whatever it means, that all we have an intuition of it, and that's metaphysics, right? You cannot tell you with detail. I mean, you have to start somewhere.
I'm not sure, exactly sure I'm understanding the question, but I'm going to go into that also.
Well, you're saying that T is just a symbol, but when you want to interpret it, even if there are many ways of measuring the interval between T1 and T2, but what it means, the position of some object at T1 and at T2 means there are two different moments
yes.
in time.
Is that metaphysics now, or is it just a fact of nature?
Oh, no, for me it's metaphysics.
Okay.
But you can just weed it out. I mean,
yes.
Complete, I mean, there is...
So
something
that
you cannot define that is the substance of what
yeah. So I would also say that, yes, so this kind of discussion I would label as metaphysics, and I sort of want to, because I'm going to say something sort of very, very down to earth also. There's all no problem, I mean, all possible questions one can have about time and, you know, becoming and being and all this different, and that's a different topic really. These are, of course, related. Now if you take this idea or this interpretation, T is absolute time, or the T in the equations of motion, we can get a qualitative definition of what time should be. So, the first comment here that we just said before, from the point of view of the equations of motion, the distinction between relative and absolute time is very natural. Here's my equations, they govern the physical system, which might be a clock. And then there's a T in the equations, and there's the clock reading there. So, of course, they're different concepts. So this is a very And Newton is perfectly correct saying that, look here, there's two different notions of time in my theory. Be careful here. What you read on the clock might not be an accurate representation or accurate with respect to the T, which you have in the equations. So we realize that there's a special symbol T in the equations of motion, and that the readings of a physical clock need not accurately march in step with that T, and so cannot be identified with it. This is the main point of the scolium, one of the main points, and that's what we take from his quote there. By aid of Newton's absolute time, that is the symbol in the equations of motion, we can now provide a definition of what accurate clock is. Clock should march in step with T. That's it. So here's how to sort of provide a theory of duration then. So in order to make this precise, we first provide a theoretical model of a physical system representing the clock. So this model dependence coming in here, we need to model the system. Assume then that the clock is composed of n point particles, blah, 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 interacting through some forces. Of course, we can include strings, fluids, membranes, whatever we like, causal sets. But just for simplicity, we stick to point particles here. So given some initial data and given some initial velocity, we get a unique solution, x of t, to the equations of motion, our theoretical model of the clock. We further assume that the clock reading T is a function of the dynamical variables. This is very natural because this thing here contains LCDs and stuff like that, and from the positions of all these particles here, or membranes or whatever they are, or just fluids, I can read off what the time is. So for an ordinary clock, it would just be the angle of the clock arm. So that's this function here. It's some way of reading off the time from the fundamental variables. Then here's the theoretical notion of a clock. An accurate clock is a physical system described by some variables, x of t, such that the reading of the clock satisfies this. So it's affinely related to the Newtonian time. Or, if you look at duration instead, you take the difference here, that should just be a constant times delta t. So in this expression up here, a is just an irrelevant starting time, and b just a choice of units, basically. So this is a bit surprising. If you read in the philosophical literature, there's been books written about the protophysics of time and so on, and many people tend to miss all of that. This, you know, as a concrete way of thinking about it. I think one of the reasons why is because they want a model or a theory-independent notion of time somehow, but that's not going to be possible. You need theory in order to define time. So this notion of clock is, of course, very much in rooted in Newtonian physics, and also about a particular model, rooted in a particular model of the clock. So we should see more about that. So it's important to recognize that this definition of an accurate clock is model dependent, and there's no way of getting around this. Indeed, how can we know that the physical clock was accurately modeled theoretically? How do we know this? How do we know that we didn't neglect important friction terms, that we inserted, should be here, correct numerical values of the masses, other constant, etc.? How do you justify these things? It's weird. Is it even worse? This is frozen.
It's clearly not an accurate.
I knew I had it coming.
Hopefully Jacob will come up then.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. At least I have. But maybe now, if sort of, but this is just running here, so. Okay, now it's probably okay, no?
Yeah, that's good. Try the clicker. Okay.
Okay, good. So here's an example of this model dependence of clocks. So for a long time, people thought that the sidereal time was a good measure of absolute time. Yeah, no, everything. It might be that the computer went to sleep or something like that. I don't know what happened. So sidereal time is just the rotation of Earth, and you're on it here, and you see the stars. And the angle from some fixed thing on Earth here of the star is going to measure sidereal time. So it was long recognized that solar time wasn't accurate because they couldn't make predictions of solar eclipses and so on. They had to use this notion of sidereal time, which is more accurate. There's some discrepancy of 15 minutes or something like that between sidereal and solar time because we're actually rotating. So
15 minutes per
year. Or it varies, plus and minus 15 minutes, something like that. So now the more concrete about the model dependence. To provide a simple theoretical model of sidereal time, we assume that Earth is a perfect spherical solid with uniform density through its interior. Then we can describe the whole thing by its Euler angles. And then we solve the Newton's equations of motion. And these are the Euler angles here, constant, and you get the linear dependence here. And then you say, oh, this is good. The third Euler angle can be taken as a clock reading because it relates to t here. Thus, with these assumptions, the third Euler angle can be regarded as the reading or a sidereal clock, the rotating Earth. And it's also an accurate clock because it's just linearly or finally related to the Newtonian time. But then there were these problems with this notion of time. So in the end of the 19th century, astronomers observed puzzling accelerations of the moon. the moon was observed to follow the right Newtonian trajectory through space, but with the wrong speed. The moon was observed to speed up and slow down along the Newtonian trajectory. So in order to explain these anomalous accelerations, unobserved celestial bodies were conjectured to exist. It's sort of similar to what happened with the perihelion of Mercury also. But here it's more curious in this situation, because these bodies should have also modified the trajectories, not just the speed along the trajectory. So it's only the speed and not the trajectory itself which gets modified. And how can you get that to work with extra bodies around? So given this, the resolution was to propose that sidereal time does not provide an accurate measure of duration. Once the accuracy of the sidereal time is questioned, it's easy to understand these anomalous accelerations on the moon. The Earth is not a perfect spherical solid, and its rotation will not be uniform. In reality, Earth is elliptic, and more importantly, its surface consists of water, which is influenced by the moon, and its interior is not a solid but the fluid magma. So all these things determine a very, very complicated rotation of the Earth, which is quite unpredictable also, because you need to know all about the interior of Earth, and it's extremely difficult to know initial conditions of this magma and all this kind of stuff.
I was expecting you to suggest that everything inside job.
It's all a conspiracy here. Yeah. So if you construct a more accurate model, take into account the elliptical shape, interior fluid, blah, 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 then we will find, solve the Newton's equation, that gamma is not linear in T, only approximately. And we can sort of get a Taylor expansion like here. So here, we can also see the inaccuracy, right? This delta here would give us a measure of the inaccuracy. So that, of course, this is several different. Maybe this is not the best measure you can think of, but this is one measure of the inaccuracy. Probably should be omega, a delta divided by omega, because you don't want the unit to be. So it was proposed as a better notion. So they had this problem with the sidereal time. It wasn't accurate. So what to replace it with now? What clock should we trust now? And this is the end of the 19th century. Just complete the sentence. It was the end of the 19th century, so they didn't have cesium clocks or anything like that. So they proposed a different notion of time called ephemeris time.
So, but in principle, you could just, you know, find the right delta, and then you can use any invertible function as a definition of the clock, right? You can use that formula.
But
you can still use the.
But I want an accurate clock, right?
No, if you put the right delta, it is very accurate.
If I would put, are you here now?
No, go to the previous slide.
Okay.
Very complicated model of the.
Well, even if you don't do the model, you just measure delta.
Oh yes.
And then you can use that as a clock.
Yes, and I would change the function here. I mean, I wouldn't claim that.
It's not.
So here I would invert for t here, given gamma, right? That would be a clock reading, right? So yes.
I mean, it doesn't need to be an affine.
No.
You define that like that, but an invertible function would be.
Yes, exactly. So this guy here, there's a clock reading t, which is a function of the dynamical variables. So you're not constrained to one, right? So that's a good comment. You're not constrained to say that gamma has to be my clock reading now. Since we know it's inaccurate, of course you shouldn't do that, right? You shouldn't say that this is Newtonian time. You should say, oh, here's the expression, let's solve for t here. Right, and then you're going to get a function of gamma, which would represent Newtonian time up to some fine transformation or something like that. So ephemeris time is just this simple idea. Take energy conservation. So again, here we're assuming something. We're assuming that our system has energy conservation. So if we have a subsystem, of course, we need to assume that it's isolated from the rest of the universe. If it's our solar system, we need to assume that we're far away from other bodies that could influence, you know, the energy of the solar system. So you start from this equation, and then you just solve for dt here. Oop, you get this equation here. So given displacements, how the planets change, you sum them up and weight by the masses, divide by E, divide by E minus V here, you get how much a Newtonian clock would have ticked. So this is the integrated form. If you give a curve, it would look like this.
So this is joint definition.
Yes.
Because it's not clear
that what he's saying
is actually what astronomers
do. Yes. It's not clear. So, but I'm going to call it the ephemeris time here. As it might be that, well, let's return to that also. It's not absolutely clear. So here, this lambda is, of course, a new parameter. That could represent whatever you like. Maybe it represented sidereal time. And by plugging things in here and using this d lambda here, which is the sidereal clock tick, we would get how the sidereal time is related to the Newtonian time, which wouldn't be exactly the same, a little bit different. So in order to determine t, we must first empirically determine the displacements of the planets in the solar system, and then plug in this data in a Baur expression for ephemeris time. So for about 30 years before the introduction of the atomic clocks, astronomers made use of the ephemeris time as a more accurate measure of duration. How did they do that? So at first sight, we might think that this notion of ephemeris time provides us with an ultimate solution to our problem, an operational definition of duration. But this is not true. In order to correctly calculate the ephemeris time from the empirically measured displacements, we need to know a priori what the masses are. How do we know them? That was a huge problem for astronomers. We also need to know other constants appearing in the potential. And we also need to know the energy, which is also in the expression for ephemeris time. And then on top of that, we also know these displacements we can only observe in one reference frame, but we might not be in an inertial reference frame, and this thing will depend on it. So there's all kinds of problems with that expression if you would like it to be an applicable notion of time that you can just sort of ready for use. So how do the astronomers know which frames are inertial frames? After all, Earth is rotating, hurling around the Sun, which is itself hurling around the Milky Way. So this is, we're all in the system, right? And depending how much we're rotating, how much we're hurling, this delta XK will be different. So, and we need to know so here's sort of when it comes to more and more to the Skolian problem. Now we see that these masses here, this our rotation and motion with respect to the inertial reference frames that are lacking here, right? And we see that really to operationally identify inertial frames and to operationally determine an accurate measure of duration, that is Newton's absolute time. I misread my own sentence. Well, this is the problem. The Skolian problem is to operationally identify inertial frames and to operationally determine an accurate measure of duration. So, and then you need to determine the masses, you need to determine the energy, etc., etc. So everything becomes very, very intertwined here. It's not like you can just isolate the problem of a theoretical definition of duration. Say, all right, I want to solve this problem first, and then I'm going to figure out how I can determine my motion with respect to inertial reference frames and so on. Wow, this is a small. Yep.
So what's wrong with using just a free particle as a
How do you know it's free?
Because, I mean, for this problem also, you have this problem. I mean, you have the same problem because how do you know there is no external field or external potential that affect this, for example, gravitational system?
So
I mean, having this potential doesn't solve that problem.
So, yeah.
But as this wind is free, you don't care, I mean, you don't care about mass or...
So if you can know that a system is free, like a particle like that, and then yes, that would be a good notion of time. If your rods are correct and if your these things are correct, yeah.
So are you claiming that introducing this potential or solve that problem?
Which is the potential? Which is the potential?
Vx or V here.
Well, this is the thing that describes the system. So,
I'm saying that if.
Yes.
I mean, you are making the same assumption that it's not. I mean, it's just.
So.
System.
So, this model, yes. I would say yes. So. So you can say that. So there's also a question how accurate you can get. For example, you may take this free particle to just be something you're rolling on ice or something like that. So the Skolem problem for astronomers, so this is also in a sort of historical setting, right? They could take a puck on ice and saying, this is without forces, I can neglect sort of the friction and so on. But in reality, it's not a very precise notion of a clock because we know there's a lot of friction here and so on. So that would be my answer to that. So but you're right. I mean, if I have access to something which is clearly free of forces, which we don't have around Earth here, I would be using that thing. But in absence of such a thing, I need to start thinking about how I could define a clock or define the Newtonian time from observations. So is that sort of clear? No? Yeah. So, yes, this is a good, important clarification. So this Skolem problem is within historical context, right? They're astronomers. From Newton's times and onward, and they're really suffering because they don't have a good clock, right? They don't have this free particle around. And the only thing they had was this sidereal time for a long time. And in order to improve on that definition, or improve the clock standard, they're going through this idea of ephemeris time and so on. And now, of course, we have cesium clocks, which are even better. So, yes, so in the end, everything is going to be model dependent. Can you trust? Yes. So, Newton's Skolem problem consists of the simultaneous determination of duration, inertial reference frames, masses, and other constants for measurable quantities. So now we're going to go into the mathematical formulation of Newton's Skolem problem. But before we continue, we need one more observation. So again, which is important now, we're in the astronomer's framework here. So we cannot only directly observe from Earth the angular coordinates of the planets in the sky. The distances could perhaps be determined by a light signal, but in order to determine the distance, we then need to be able to accurately measure the time it takes, which presupposes an accurate clock, which we don't know, we don't have that yet. So there's another problem here that we cannot even measure the displacement, right? The radial part is sort of lacking. We shall therefore assume that the empirical data only consists of the angular coordinates that we observe on the sky.
If you don't know the distance, you don't know when you're seeing the...
Yes, so that's another thing. So again, I'm going to assume I'm in Newtonian mechanics and the speed of light is infinite.
But they already knew, astronomers knew that, wasn't it?
Yes, so okay. There's some kind of fudging. You could put that in here also. So that would be an improvement. And they actually, the astronomers now are actually putting that into. I mean, they were doing that in the when they were using ephemeris time. They were taking into effect this line time. You see the angle here, but actually the planet is actually a little bit further ahead. So, and that complicates the problem further. So we're just going to assume that it's the angle accordance we can observe. And we're going to assume, as Raphael points out, that we see the actual angles. This is non-trivial. In order to improve, we need actually to put in the finite propagation of light and so on. So let these guys be the positions of all the planets in some Euclidean reference frame, be it inertial or not. We assume that x3 represents the motion, the position of the Earth, so that x3 is just zero, for example. So this would define our origin, our Euclidean reference frame. So now we express the positions of the planets in spherical polar coordinates with respect to Earth here. The latter two are the angular coordinates that we can directly measure or observe from Earth, but this guy here is unknown. We just see a point there, and we can't really see how big it is, because either it's a small but close planet, or it's a big planet far away. So, here comes Raphael's point here. The speed of light is infinite, and there's no light bending. These two assumptions, of course, false, but justifiable since we're interested in attacking the Skolian problem within Newtonian mechanics. But of course, there is light bending in Newtonian mechanics if you apply the equivalence principle. So it's
and also the significance of light, isn't that
one
of the ways they measure the speed of light was eclipses of the moons of Jupiter or something like that.
Yes.
So
there's
a practical issue.
Yes.
It's ephemeris time.
Yeah, so this gives a significant contribution, I mean, to the accuracy. I don't know the details yet. And it's very hard to find the sort of details how they were using ephemeris time.
Yeah.
Well, I shouldn't say that, because if I ask the experts, they say it's all muddy. So that's Julian. Yeah?
Would you hear that ideally what you'd want to do in these situations is solve things self-consistently. So I could start with my bad notion of time.
Yes.
Right? Using that bad notion, I calculate the distance to planets, I get a better approximation of time.
Yes.
And then I use that correction factor, so I realize that my clocks I used originally aren't linear functions of time, but I have a new estimate of what monotonic function they are, and then I redo the calculation using that, and I keep going until I converge to some notion of time.
So I'm going to do things a bit different. Apparently that's how the astronomers were doing it. They had this iterative process. They were guessing the masses, the distances, and so on, and they were putting it in, and they would get a sort of improved estimates, and the sort of, maybe that's the fastest way to do it. I'm just going to pose an analytical problem, and you solve everything once and for all, no iterative process. So this is coming up now. So so the terrestrial Euclidean reference frame is not an inertial reference frame. So its mathematical relation to inertial reference frame is not known a priori. So let's just assume that this is an inertial reference frame. Then the Euclidean frame X, which sort of is the Earth frame, is related to the inertial frame Y by some unknown and possibly time-dependent action of the Euclidean group. So X is some rotation and translation like this. So maybe I could turn on the lights, because here
you think you can wrap it up in a few minutes?
Now? Yeah, it's just about. This is just the end here. Maximum 5-10 minutes left. So, So how do we calculate these unknowns now? So let me just... So we have some inertial reference frame, which is related to a... I might have used some different notation. This is a translation, that's a rotation. This is an inertial reference frame, and that's the Euclidean frame, the Earth-based reference frame. So those are related by some possibly time-dependent rotation here, like this. And furthermore, Newtonian time, we're going to have some lambda, which is some, T is some F of lambda. So this is the relation between our bad clock, whatever it is, ideal time, whatever, and Newtonian time. And this relation we don't know a priori. So then you can just, if you write down the equations of motion in such a reference frame now, then you get a familiar expression. Well, sort of a familiar. So this n here is f prime of lambda, where prime is lambda derivative. So to be more explicit, how would you solve for the unknowns now? Here you would have unknown. So let's just write down the unknowns first. So you have unknowns here because xi is equal to ri and sine theta I. Cosine phi I, etc. here. Right? So there's unknowns here, there's an unknown there, there's an unknown there.
What's capital N?
Capital N?
N.
N, that's the lapse, that's the derivative.
Okay.
So this is, if you would, this is dt is equal to lapse the lambda, like that. So if you know a bad clock tick, you multiply with n, you get the Newtonian clock tick. So the unknowns here are ri. I don't know how this changes with lambda either. And I don't know how it accelerates with lambda either. So that's three of those. And then I have omega prime. Now, first important thing here, t doesn't enter here, which is just an expression that I cannot know where the system is translationally wise. So I cannot solve for t immediately. And if you go about it, you can actually see that you cannot solve for t prime either because it's Galilean invariant. I've assumed here that this potential is Galilean invariant and rotation invariant and translation invariant. So it's actually just this guy that enters. Effectively, this guy appears explicitly, but you can see that you cannot solve for it because you can always make a Galilean transformation.
So the t double prime, that's just the acceleration of the center of mass or something?
Yes. That's basically if you would drop something locally here, that's the acceleration you would measure. And then you have the masses. And then in here, if v now is equal to, let's take an explicit example, it might be you might have a g there, some constant, which appears in the equations of motion. And you have to put it here too because you don't know it, what it is. So these are the unknowns. I don't think
what about the energy?
There's no energy in the expression. Well, these are the Newton's equations of motion. So to be more explicit, in order to solve for all these things, I need to use some equations. And here it's very clear, there's only the Newtonian equations of motion around. So that's the only thing I can use in order to determine omega. Omega is how much we're rotating with respect to inertial reference frame, and this is how much we're accelerating. So there's no energy here in this expression, because it's already the derivative of the Newton's equations of motion. And this is just the Newton's equations of motion and not the Jacobi or anything like that. So here's the first thing. If you now count the unknowns, maybe I should just let this go quickly. Just take my notes. If you count it here, you find that the unknowns are, assume these guys are the number of particles, so x. The x goes from 1 to k. Then there's 4k plus 9 unknowns, if you count them all. But there's only 3k equations. So that's a no-no. You cannot solve the problem. You have more unknowns than equations. So, of course, you have more things that you can do. I should also say, be more specific. This is your empirical input, right? So you're given those as functions of lambda, and you plug it in there. They'll give you concrete equations for all these unknowns. There's a second thing I haven't been explicit about. There's two ways of thinking about this. Either you think of these things as differential equations for the unknowns, so you will get solutions in terms of Ri of lambda and omega of lambda and so on. Or you might just say, I'm interested in solving it at a particular moment of time, and then I can sort of step forward. So this is what I'm doing here. Can I solve momentarily for how much this is rotating now? Just given these guys. And of course, from these guys, I can compute the time derivative or the lambda derivative and so on, and the second derivatives and so on. So from that, I should be able to get everything. So if I'm not allowed to take further derivatives of Newton's equations of motion, there's no way I can solve this problem. So let's, as sort of a finisher, let's look at the general problem. But I've taken the derivatives of the equations of motion. I'm just going to state it here. It's no. So this is the inequality you get. If this is satisfied, then there's the possibility of a unique solution of Newton's Scholium problem. So d is the number of derivatives. If d is zero, I've just this and no derivatives on Newton's equations of motion, then you get minus k here. And that has to be larger than 16, which is not possible. And this is what we saw here. I mean, it's not possible to solve the problem when I haven't taken derivatives. If I take just one derivative of the equations of motion, well, that becomes a half. And I see that k must be larger than 16. So which means that for our solar system, I cannot solve the Scholium problem, because there's only 10 planets. Unless you put in asteroids and so on, and then you might be able to solve it. And you can also ask the question, what's the minimum number here so that I can solve the problem? So how did this go now? I'm a bit rustier now. Okay, but let me leave that. There's something also that k has to be larger than 4 here. But that's sort of the expression. Maybe because I recalculated this just before the talk now, so I'm not...
You mean if d is equal to 2? and it's 3k greater than equal to 16, therefore.
Do I see this?
Five.
Or? There's something. Well. So I did, as said before, I just rushed into this, so I forgot a little bit about the.
What? It's just sufficient
condition. So this is the interesting question, right? So to wrap it out now, this is the heart of the problem, right? You have these equations with derivatives now. Now, if you want to be more careful, when is it then you can have uniqueness and existence of solutions? So that's really messy here, because you have to take derivatives of this guy here, so it's really messy.
You can at most, so if you also observe the derivatives, you have theta phi, theta prime, phi prime, so you have 4k things that you...
What are you saying?
So I'm trying to count.
I could try to do the counting just.
What he said is that when you allow yourself to be measured in derivatives, then you have more information than
I don't understand the counting.
Rather than doing the calculation, why don't we?
Well,
first of all, thanks, Hans, for this talk. I assume that you're.
I have a very short conclusion. Where did I put that? There it is. That's the conclusion.
All right, well, let's thank you.